Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 3rd of February 1924, the gold standard defended. But first, some of the other items that have caught my attention this week. The funeral of Lenin has taken place in Moscow. Trotsky was nowhere to be seen, because he has lost the power struggle in the Kremlin. To mark the event, the funeral, not Trotsky's difficulties, Petrograd has been renamed Leningrad. In Omsk, railway workers locked the local Communist Committee in during a meeting and burnt the building to the ground. Riots in Russia, eh? Couldn't happen today. There is a bit of good news for the Communists. Britain's new Labour government is looking to officially recognise the Soviet Union. The strike which paralysed Britain's rail network last week has ended. In the US, what will become known as the Teapot Dome scandal has broken. The Secretary of the Interior has been accused of taking bribes to allow oil companies to drill on government land. The scandal came to light when people started to notice that the Secretary, a Mr. Fall, had become mysteriously wealthy all of a sudden. It wouldn't be the last time an American politician acquired wealth which would be difficult to explain by reference to his salary alone. Over the last year or so that I've been producing these videos, I've had very little to say about India, then part of the British Empire. There's a good reason for that. I don't understand it. This week, the Times published an article from a correspondent on the political situation. From what I can glean, there is some sort of national native representation, although it is unclear how wide the franchise is, or how much power the resultant representative body wields. As the secessionists, or Swarajists as they are known, are dominant, I would say it wields very little power. The two dominant figures in Indian politics are the jailed Gandhi, as you might expect, and Nehru, as you might also expect, but we would be wrong to, because this Nehru is the father rather than the son, although the son and future Indian Prime Minister will have his day in the sun soon enough. India is not the only imperial irritation. This is from Tuesday, the 29th of January. A most important and far-reaching legal decision affecting race relationships in South Africa has been given recently. Three judges of the Supreme Court of the Transvaal have unanimously declared that Regulation 179, generally known as the Colour Bar, of the Mines, Works and Machinery Act No. 12 of 1911, is ultra vires the Enabling Act. I'm going to guess that this is an act which empowers a devolved assembly rather than one that allows rulers to lock up their political opponents and rule by decree. The regulation provides that the operation of or attendance on machinery shall be in charge of a competent shiftsman, and in the Transvaal and Orange Free State provinces, such shiftsman shall be a white man. Just so you know, this is before apartheid. Interesting that it has taken 12 years for this to be tested in court. The judgment itself is couched in language of dignity and weighty deliberation, and is worthy of the best traditions of the South African bench. It makes an implied protest against government by regulation, which is becoming too common in South Africa, and vindicates the right of the court to decide upon the reasonableness of regulations made under any act. The idea that regulations are out of control is not an uncommon theme in the Times of the 1920s. Of course, things are so much better today. Of course, one way in which we are not so much better today is in the provision of trams. In those days, trams were, well, if not ubiquitous, very close to it. But not everyone is a fan. This is from Friday the 1st of February. To people in motor cars, in taxicabs, in horse carriages, and even in omnibuses, nothing is so sharp an annoyance as a tram car. A stupid thing that will not give and take, that can only move along its own rigid lines. It is like the bore who can only talk along his one subject, and interrupted in the middle of a sentence, will begin that very sentence all over again. Some novelist lately attempted to defend the tram car as a beautiful thing. He was careful to choose the night time, when the tram car is invisible and only its lights can be seen. At least in those days they were capable of paying their own way. Talking of paying one's own way, this time on a rather larger scale, this week the Times published the Annual Financial and Commercial Review, a supplement dedicated to what we would nowadays call the economy. This is from the introduction. The main course of economic events in 1923 was not unfavourable. On the whole, there was a great recovery from the depression which followed the hectic boom of 1919 to 1920. The post-armistice boom reached its height as reflected in wholesale commodity prices in April 1920. Then the great storm burst, and by the end of 1921, about three-fifths of the post-war advance had disappeared. It goes on to say that unemployment is down and production up. I wish I knew a bit more about the post-First World War boom, but I don't. I'm guessing that it was the result of wartime government money printing, because money printing is usually the cause of booms and busts. The review includes an article by a Professor Nicholson on the subject of monetary policy. Referring to monetary policy and the return to the gold standard after the Napoleonic Wars, he has this to say. The Bank of England no doubt mismanaged its advances, and the comment of Tooke is instructive. Tooke was a 19th century economist. The directors were persuaded that it is part of their functions to promote and uphold the commerce of the country, whereas the trade of the country can never be in a satisfactory state if it is made to depend on the patronage or protection of the bank. There is a reason I refer to it as the Bank of Evil. But seriously, as long as I can remember, the Bank of England interest rate has been a matter of huge political importance. And it is very much the view of far too many people that it is the bank, and by extension the government, that is responsible for delivering growth, or lower unemployment, or low inflation. Nicholson then goes on to demolish some of the myths that surround the gold standard. Or perhaps surrounded would be a better way of putting it. Most of these are new ones on me. There is no foundation for the common belief that the gold standard in the period 1815 to 1847 caused a continuous depression of trade. What? This was the Industrial Revolution in its pomp. Railways, textiles, ceramics, iron, steel, coal. The common assumption that the gold standard established in 1816 to 1821 lessened the accumulation of wealth and increased the burden of the national debt is not confirmed by history. Anything else means money printing. Money printing means boom and bust. Perhaps I should say bigger booms and bigger busts. No human system is perfect. As regards the supply of gold, the annual addition is always small compared to the total mass. The gold standard is not a silver bullet. New gold finds can destabilise the system, just typically not very much. He then says this about the gold market. India, for example, before the war imported in one average year £7 million worth of gold bullion and £12 million worth of sovereigns, a large number of these being melted down. Indians like gold jewellery. And as I understand it, nothing has changed. Nowadays, in our world of inflation, boom and bust, those who advocate gold as money are often regarded as cranks. In the 1920s, against the background of pre-First World War price stability and steady growth, they were regarded as rational and level-headed. Anyway, that's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.